This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. Composer and writer Rindy Eckert could barely get through Moby Dick, but he did three times, all the way through, cover to cover, and on the final reading, he started to understand why it was a masterpiece, which is a good thing because Moby Dick is the driving force behind Eckert's play and God Created Great Whales. It's about a composer trying to create an opera based on Melville's epic novel. But the catch is the composer is slowly losing his memory. Playmakers putting on the two-person show on the campus of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. And Obie Award winner Rindy Eckert is here on the program. Well, and now I got the I in both names.
You did
Rindy
well,
Eckert. I'm getting close. He's reprising his role as the composer in that show, and he joins us now. Rindy, welcome. Good to have you here.
Good to be here, Frank.
Give us a little synopsis about the show. It's not an adaptation of Moby Dick. This is
No. It's about a composer who's trying to write an opera based on Moby Dick. And he is hindered in his project by the fact that his memory is disappearing. He's got some sort of brain disorder that is getting in his way. So he has used a kind of artifice to help him. He's got an imaginary friend, a woman who is modeled on an opera singer. Whose piano he tuned. And so we have this fictional, this imaginary friend is helping him do this, which is my colleague Nora Cole plays what we call the muse. And Nathan is the name of the composer, and Nathan and the muse spend the entire time performing scenes from the opera, then arguing about scenes from the opera, and then trying to get Nathan to remember to get him back on track. So
I love it already because the disintegrating mind is the tool that comes up with the way that we can get around the problem of the disintegrating mind.
Yeah.
Isn't that wonderful?
That's yeah.
So where'd the idea for this show come from?
Well, I had started out with a much more abstract idea and it was just totally unworkable. I wanted to make a piece about a piano tuner who was trying to tune a white piano perfectly. So I thought this would be my Moby Dick would be this piano tuner in the struggle to reach a kind of perfection. It was all around the idea of perfection and how it drove 19th century culture and then similarly on into the 20th century. And it's kind of hubris that we can. You know, be perfected, and loses track of a kind of a basic human condition. So I was interested in that, but it got too abstract. I had to spend a half an hour trying to describe tuning, and it just was totally unworkable. So I needed a new project for him in the opera to be able to complete an opera of that magnitude for a lowly piano tuner. Kind of, it was I think the right move.
I don't know if the piano had human legs.
Yeah.
That would be a great twist, wouldn't it?
Well, I had this idea. It was you know, graphically, it was going to be really great because I kept on thinking he's going to add, like, wires to the thing until this piano would become this mass of wires and perfection looked like this strange thing and the sound of it was completely unrecognizable.
But this is, in a way, what Melville – well, I should ask you then how Moby Dick entered the picture first.
Well, as soon as I decided that I really needed to just – I needed to tell the story of Moby Dick. I needed that to be an anchor. That I didn't want to do this in too abstract a manner. That I had to drive through the novel, then I used it as kind of cues.
And did it really take you three? I mean, who reads Moby Dick?
Well,
three times?
On the second reading, I started getting the inklings. But on the third reading, you're reading in different ways. The first time, you just want to take the journey.
Yeah.
The second time, you are now alert to the structural kind of magic that's happening, and then the second time the structural magic. The third time you start picking out specific details because you're no longer enamored of the structural magic in the first time, and you're not doing just the flat out reading of the thing, just as a story. You're now able to free your mind up to other tasks, and then you start seeing little details. And at that moment, when you see the little details in there, some microcosm that that somehow it's like a hologram.
Yeah,
it really is. You go in and there's this little detail that seems to frame the entire work. So that's when it gets really interesting.
Now, one of those details, I understand, for you was Ahab's pipe when he throws it.
Yeah, I included it in the piece, in fact, because I thought it was such a critical moment, and I was struck by it. There's a moment when Ahab, and he's hunting this whale fiercely, and he's convinced his crew to hunt this thing. He's obsessed by this white whale. He's on deck, and it describes him taking his pipe and throwing it into the sea. And of course, the pipe is a kind of emblem of the bourgeois. It's like his fireplace at home, you know. And he casts away everything of that world and dedicates himself at that moment to this pursuit. And Melville does this great thing when he describes the pipe hitting the water, and then he describes the bubbles. He describes the pipe sinking and the bubbles rising. And so it's this, you feel that idea of there's something sinking and something rising. And then he describes the ship then moving across those bubbles. So you get this horizontal thing moving over this vertical phenomenon, and then he follows that with a description of Ahab crossing the deck. And so the movement of the ship, and Ahab is athwart, going back and cross. So you get these kind of juxtaposed crosses, and you realize he really wants you to know this is a crux. This is actually a crossing point. He's at a turning point in the life of, and now there's no going back.
That elaborate description, of course, was Melville's version of your wires. I mean, that's what what people criticized, and why the book, by the way, didn't do so well when
exactly.
it came out.
Exactly.
And yet all of this stuff is embedded in there, so you unpack it.
Yeah.
And then talk about this other play. So give us a little more now of a plot summary. Give us a sense of what's happening.
Well, the piece is basically in three different acts. Each, and it's in one act, but there's no act break. We don't have an intermission. But each act is kind of punctuated by a white noise. And that white noise symbolizes the disappearance, a sudden disappearance of the mind. And periodically, he goes into this kind of white noise space. Each time he awakens, so it's three awakenings. And each time he awakens, he has to be reminded of who he is. And he's made a tape for himself, which he wears. He has a cassette tape recorder, which he's strapped to his tape, duct taped to him, literally duct taped to him. And he every time he awakens from one of these episodes, he has to punch play, and it plays again. It tells him who he is and what he's doing. And he introduces his imaginary friend again each time. And progressively, you get farther and farther into the tape. Ultimately, of course, he reaches the end of that tape. And as it turns out, he's anticipated that at some point his mind will be so far gone that the tape won't do him any good. Mm. And there's a very poignant moment at the end of the play where it says, "There's no longer any need to rewind this tape." And at that moment, you realize he's done. And the muse, in fact, has died. Everything has died within him, and there's nothing left but a kind of following certain instructions. In the end, he says, "Sit down, Nathan. You've done well." And that's the end.
And what all of this?
It's not actually the end. There's an epilogue, but
What all of this alerts us to, and I think demonstrates, is that even though we try to remember and reconstitute, everything has changed. And even if our mind isn't disintegrating, it has moved on.
Yeah.
And so those memories are in a new context, and they create a whole new situation for us. It's a wonderful way to render that. Although you did miss an opportunity, it seems to me that you could have also blended Melville with Proust.
Yeah.
And you could have done In Search of Lost Time.
Yeah, you know, maybe that should be the sequel.
Wouldn't that be great?
Just get it
down to, it wouldn't even have to be a whole act, I don't think. 20 minutes, you'd be done. You have written the book and the music for this.
Yes.
You star in this. What are the challenges of obviously you save a few bucks. That's the first thing.
That is the first thing. But I have special skills, so it's difficult to find someone with those particular skills. I can make my way around a piano. And I have a wide range in my voice, in my singing voice, and I'm a trained actor. So there's a reason why I'm kind of at the center of it. But there are challenges in that when you're writing the piece, you are both the writer and the composer, there is a part of you when you're rehearsing that is sitting back, you know, in that chair in the audience going, oh, that's, I need to fix that. I need to, oh, that line, I don't like that line. I need to, like, oh, this has got to be shorter. And it gets in the way of your acting. You can't actually act the part. And so David Schweitzer, the wonderful director who led us through this thing, Nora and I, at one point, and he understood this dilemma, and he understood that I had to be kind of removed as an actor in order to continue to be a composer and a writer. But I think it was a week and a half before we were due to go up, as they say. And he said, "Rindy, you have to stop being composer and writer. You have to invest as an actor now. I need you to do that for me." So I had to stop. I had to really stop myself and be an actor and invest as an actor in that character.
I mean, could you do that?
Yes, I was able to do that, it's from long practice at having to do the same thing over and over again. But I always need to be reminded when the moment arrives.
You have to turn that tape on.
I have to turn that little switch in my head that says no more. And Nora, of course, needed it too. She needed an actor there who was going to be actually responsive to her.
Did you write this with you in mind as Nathan?
Yes. That was one of the conditions, I think, of the commission too. And that often happens. I will get commissioned, and one of the stipulations in the contract will be that I have to be performing at the center of it.
A couple of key themes for me that are powerful in this play, and I wonder which drives you. There's certainly the whole business of consciousness, who we are, who we think we are.
Yeah.
The miracle of waking up remembering who we are.
Exactly.
Right? I mean, there's that. And then how we carry that forward and how we can remain creative. And then the question that Melville and the Transcendentalists were sort of facing, how do we keep the wonder in this world that we are now inventing in our own image?
Yeah, I think we still, of course, face that question, maybe more so now than the Transcendentalists were only guessing at what might happen. And in fact, it has happened.
Worse, I think.
Yes, much, much worse. And we are now struggling with how to reframe this for ourselves so that we can recapture some of that mystery. We've become a little jaded, and in that jadedness, it's encouraged a kind of hubris that's allowed us to think that somehow we are above nature and that we are actually in control. Hurricane Sandy reminds us that we're not really in control, and it's I think a compelling question now.
Well, and how to answer it, whether it's Nathan's problem or solution. Let's let my mind. I got myself out here. I'm going to have to get myself back through my own contraption, or whether it's your director's good advice to you to simply let it go. And become who you were meant to be and see where that takes
you. I think there is a value to thinking. I think the computer has something to say about this. I love the idea of the restart. And I've now gotten in the habit of awakening every morning going, I don't know a thing. You know, let's start with the assumption that I don't know a thing, and let's build from there. I think the Buddhists call it beginner's mind, where you look at the situation and all the little stories you've told yourself about it, you abandon all those stories and say, let's take a fresh look at this. Let's look at the world. Let's take it in before we start telling all sorts of stories about it.
Seems to me that could be very helpful to you as an actor as well.
It is. It is, very much so. Every time you step on stage, you basically have to do that same thing. You leave that personality behind and you say, now it's my obligation is to be totally present here for this audience.
Right. So you know the lines, but you have to respond uniquely as though you hadn't
exactly
heard it before.
Yeah.
So, and before this, you had done a work based on Dante's Divine Comedy. You don't mess around when you for your inspirations. How do you compare these two?
I had to. In fact, the reason why I was doing Moby Dick was because of the work I did on Dante. A friend of mine came to me after Dante and said, "You know, you really got to come back to America. The Dante is great, but you know, time to deal with an American classic." And but Dante, of course, was a great. And I did the whole thing. I didn't do the Inferno alone. I did Inferno, Purgatorio, and Paradiso all within an hour and a half.
Oh, in for a penny, in for a pound.
But I tend to like big ideas. Wrestling with big ideas. And if it's not big enough, if it's not a big enough idea, I'm just not interested in it. There are all sorts of – I think there are all sorts of ideas that have a lot of different formats. But for me, the theater is a place for grappling with whales,
yeah.
You know, and for grappling with large ideas. And you have this – you want to change the quality of that room, and you want people to move into this to a large world in that space, which you can only create through the kind of smells and the dynamics of an actual physical performance. It's different than the movies. Your mind works so much differently in the theater because it's actually there.
Yeah.
You know, I'm actually a threat. You know, I could jump off the stage.
Right.
You know, I'm actually there. You can actually smell me.
Yeah, we haven't totally lost the ability to respond viscerally to actual human presence.
Exactly.
But there's a feeling abroad that we are losing this and that the theater is no longer the place for big ideas. And yet, And God Created Great Whales, won an Obie. So it's working. Big ideas are still working. Are you the last of your species, the last of the great white whales, or is there a hope that this kind of big idea can still be staged?
I think that, no, I'm by no means the last of my species, and I think that it's going to come back in spades. I think we've been distracted a lot by a lot of very attractive media. But this, you got to remember, this has lasted for thousands of years, and I don't think that that a little dip in our popularity is going to make a huge difference. People are coming back to this thing, and I look to young people that they're simply bored by other media, and they come into the theater and they get whacked in the same way that all of us have gotten whacked by it, going, oh man, this thrills me in a way that nothing else can. I come out of this remembering things in a way that I can't. And it's, you know, we all love this other stuff, but at a certain point, what moves us, what really jostles us from a deep way, is this, and it will always do that, and may wane in popularity, but it'll come back.
You talked about a friend saying you need to come back to America with, and you chose Moby Dick. Is Moby Dick the great American novel?
I think it is. I think Melville anticipated. I think he anticipated all the things we're dealing with in Moby Dick. I think that's partially why it was difficult for people in the 19th century, in 1853 or whatever, to grasp, is because it was larger than its time, and. He knew that even in his introduction, his relationship of Queequeg and Ishmael prefigures this whole question of the sophisticated man and the primitive man, and the need for a relationship between them, the need for a bond, and that bond is in Moby Dick ultimately Ishmael's salvation. He is buoyed up at the end by Queequeg's coffin. It's Queequeg's coffin that saves him and that allows the story to be told. And I think that's a huge lesson for us all.
Rindy, fabulous to have you here. Thank you so much for putting this on and for being on our program today.
Thanks, Frank.
Rindy Eckert is writer, composer, and one of the stars of And God Created Great Whales, playmakers showing it at Keenan Theater on the campus of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill through Sunday. Go to playmakersrep.org for more details. Coming up, we're going to eat our way through China with journalist Audra Ang. Stay tuned.